Welcome everyone to the second installment of Arthros of the Ages. Today we are going to be dealing with the second primary translation, namely the translation of the Torah into Aramaic. So before we start, feel free to 1 second. Can you just mute your audio coming out of it?
Pardon me?
On the phone on there. No, you could stay in the meeting. It's just okay. Sorry about that. Just some people are trying to join or in person and using so we all have the same page of this PowerPoint. Didn't remember to set up a projector because last week everybody was on Zoom. So I was surprised by people showing up in person. So what can you do? Next week they'll have a nice big screen behind me, so we'll all be able to see equally and see each other too. So that's for next week. But in the meantime, Targumim, right? So what are they? So let me first ask everybody, what do you know about a Targum?
Okay, I won't try it again.
Targum, my God. Oh, somebody's seeing
this. What happened?
Okay, so currently Leon is answering. He knows the Targum Onkelos, Targum Yonatan, and some new ones. So we're going to get into all of them and what they are and where they're from. So simply put, a Targum, yes, sorry if you can't hear from the rest of the people in the room in person, I will repeat what they say. Don't worry. So as far as what is a Targum, so the simplest explanation is it is a translation into Aramaic. So of the Torah. That's what a Targum means, translated into Aramaic. So Targum is it's for Aramaic, otherwise it would be a different language. Meaning, as in the first, for instance, the Targum Shivim isn't referred to as just plain Targum, it's referred to as Targum Shivim whenever it's mentioned. We'll get next week, we'll talk about Rav Sadia Gaon and his Tafsir, which is basically means the simple understanding in Arabic, but we will, means understand, it means like translation in Arabic, but it's referred to, that's the name it goes by. Okay, so now again,
Targum, I think, was more also an interpretation that was
just. Yes, correct. So Targum refers to a specific translation. So if you generally, if you ever see, you know, let's say, if you, in the Gemara, it says Targum be done our Targum, they're referring specifically to Targum Onkelos. It's got a specific weight and importance, just the word Targum itself. Technically, like modern Hebrew, Targum means translation, but like the Targum something, right? So there used to be a person called the Targumon in the time of the Gemara who would translate or repeat in a louder or clarified form that what the person who was giving the lecture would say. As in, when we say the rest of today, when I say Targum, I mean a translation into Aramaic of the biblical text.
And one more thing, I think it's more than a translation; it has holiness in itself.
Ah, good point. Do the Targum have holiness in and of themselves? We will get to that as well, right? So that's a subject to debate: is there any holiness to translations, particularly this one, right? So we mentioned last week there's something special about that. The Gemara had said you can only translate into Greek, yet we have a Targum into Aramaic, which becomes the more important translation than the Septuagint. And why? Also questions we'll try and deal with. Okay? So, all right. So now, why would we have a Targum? What do we think? Everybody feel free to chime in, unmute yourselves and shout it out. All right? So as Leon's saying that people forgot Hebrew. Right, and that's why we have it. So that is one option, but that goes against. I believe that was what Mark had said about. There's two marks. Mark Mitchkowitz had said that it's actually about. Like I said, is it just because people forgot it, or is there something inherently special about the Targum? Also, we're going to discuss that. We're going to discuss also which Targumim there are. We mentioned some of them. I'll give you a full list and show some excerpts from all of them. And also, I'll talk a little bit about how Targum became part of usage in Shul. If anybody happens to be in Shari Shemaim, I'll be talking more about that at Shari Shemaim after the Shkaminian. If you happen to live down south or know anybody who is, tell them to come to the Shabbaton for Beit Midrash this week there. Okay. So now let's get into it. So why do we have Targumim, right? So as Leonard pointed out, the issue is that, well, people didn't really know Aramaic anymore. Didn't know Hebrew, they only knew Aramaic. So that's kind of strange. Isn't, you know, Hebrew called Ivrit because that's the language of the Jews? So the answer is, well, yes. But also, we'll look into that history in a second. And also it's important to note that there is an idea. Its source is not entirely clear because it's first mentioned by Rashi's commentary on the Gemara, where he says that it was, you know, set written in Baruch HaKodesh, and then somehow it became to mean that it was Nitan B'Sinai, like literally, as it was, which is hard to say. The traditions that are included in it were given would make more sense, but say that the Jews got a translation they didn't speak yet is a little strange, but we shall see. So as far as the Jews' understanding of Aramaic or not, so to this we have to look at, well, welcome back. So this is by the siege of Yerushalayim in the time of Yeshayahu, and the time of Chizkiyahu Melech, right? So here we have the problem of Rav Shakeh, scaring people by speaking to them in Hebrew, and here's the response of defenders on the walls. The head defenders. They say, "Please," I'll read in Hebrew because we all speak Hebrew, and then I'll do it in English because we don't all speak English or Hebrew. So, just in case you don't know both languages, so Dabar na alavadecha aramit kishomim anachnu va'al tzeber imanu yehudit bozne ha'am asher alachoma. Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in Judean in the hearing of the people on the wall. So here we had that in the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, towards the end of it. So the nobility understood Hebrew and Aramaic, whereas the common folk only spoke Hebrew. So they're trying to say, like, don't scare everybody. Of course, Rav Shakeh ignores them because his point was to scare everybody. So to only scare the nobility is kind of not the point if you're trying to demoralize people during a siege. So he kept on going. He kept on going in Hebrew. But if we fast forward a couple hundred years to the second Beit HaMikdash, namely during the time of the return, the time of Nehemiah. So there we have Nehemiah chastising the people for having intermarried to a large degree. And there he says, "Uvnehem chatzim medaber ashdudi, ve'inam makirim medaber yehudit, v'chilshon am va'am." So a good number of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and the language of those various peoples and did not know how to speak Judean, right? So that's not really necessarily a good thing. Point is that they didn't really quite understand. Clear? Right? So then we went from everybody being fluent in Hebrew and barely knowing Aramaic to the exact opposite. Everybody knowing the languages of Aramaic and those dialects and nobody knowing. It's called Yehudit here, but again, we now would call Hebrew, they used to call Yehudit, because that was the language of the Judeans who lived in the kingdom of Judea. Okay, so everybody's following? Okay. I know some people, if it's too small or you can't read, just let me know, and I'll happily keep reading it out loud and whatnot. Okay, so now, the next question is, what Aramaic Targum are they? Right. So what are our options for what they're called? So I have a list here. So the first one that we're going to learn about is Targum Onkelos, which is considered to be the gold standard of the Torah mentioned in the Gemara, Targum Didan. Then we have Targum Yonatan, which is a translation into Aramaic for the prophets. Then we have something called Targum Pseudo-Jonathan / Targum Yerushalmi, which we'll discuss as well. Targum Neophiti. Fragment Targums, Kairagni, the fragments, and the Pshita. Okay, we will explain what all of them are, not to worry. Just those are the Targum. If you ever hear people referring to Targum, it's one of those. Okay, with different abbreviations depending on where you're reading it. So those are the ones that are relevant. The ones that you probably will see, namely, are the first one, Targum Onkelos, and that of Targum Yerushalmi, which are typically included in the standard Mikra'ot Gedolot. So those you might see. The rest, unless you're looking for it, you probably have never seen or heard of it because it's not typically quoted by anybody. Okay, so now let's get into each of them. So first thing let's talk about is Targum Onkelos and Targum Yonatan. So this is a Gemara in Megillah. Daf Gimel and Aleph, right at the very, very beginning. So they were talking about the fact they used to have certain targum used in, that they used to use as part of synagogue worship, right? As part of the liturgy, they would read the Torah and then they would read the targum. So the question is from where is that from? So, right, so Rabbi Yirmiyah said, and some say there's Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba who said, the Aramaic translation of the Torah used in the synagogue was composed by Unculus the convert, based on the teachings of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Okay, so who wrote our translation of the Torah? Quite clearly, it is Unculus the convert. And as far as the Aramaic translation of the prophets, this was written by Yonatan ben Uzziel, based on a tradition going back to the prophets of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, meaning the last three prophets that we had. And the Gemara relates, and that something special about the translation of the fantastic nature of the translation of Nevi'im by Yonatan ben Uzziel, about how the earth quaked 400 parsangs by 400 parsangs, and a bat kol said, who has revealed my secrets to mankind? So you may the 400 by 400 might sound familiar, because this is a term that's also used by a lot of things that happened during the destruction of the temple. They say something terrible happened. They say that the earth shook 400 parsangs by 400 parsangs.
Are we saying that Unculus is the earliest?
Yeah, I mean,
it seems like before it started, Yonasan?
Yes, yeah. No question.
No, because I was thinking, you were saying before that we all know that Targum Unculus is the gold standard. Maybe it's not in terms of quality of the gold standard, you said it was the first one.
So, it seemingly is both. As in, we'll get into whether or not there were any prior or not, but definitely we're saying there is a gold standard. There is something called the Targum that we use, right, that we use in our shuls, is Targum Unculus. That is the definite opinion of the Bavli and of all those lived in Bavel. That's what they read. Question is of whether or not it actually is the original written by Unculus or not is a separate question, and whether there were any prior, there were, at least in part, because we have found archaeological evidence of some fragments. But as far as being accepted and liturgically used, the first one we know for sure was liturgically used is that of Unculus.
No, I was asking, is that because
yes,
better?
Yes, it is better, and I mean, I can bring the Gemara here, but there's a Gemara that talks about how it's that the only way you properly translate is by using Targum Unculus. Comes up as a relevant will you marry me if I can translate the Torah properly? So you'll only be married if you translate using Targum Unculus. Anything
and
else
Rashi,
would be no good. Yes,
and Rashi quotes it, so that's a pretty good reference.
Right, Rashi does quote it also, but it had its elevated status came well before Rashi's time, and in fact, we'll see that it may have actually been lesser in status at the time of Rashi than it was prior, which we'll see towards the end. So, right, so in terms of Yotam and Azil, something special, right, but when he translated it, there is all this quaking. It's interesting that there's something special by the translation of the prophets, not of the Torah, like we had last week. All the uproar was about the translation of the Torah, not about for the Septuagint. Was actually the uproar was about the Torah, not about anything else. But that is, be that as it may. So then Yonatan ben Uzziel gets up and says, "I'm the one who did it. I didn't do it for my honor, or for my house, or my father. Rather, I did it for your honor, God, so that we will people will not argue about with each other about the way you interpret." The prophets. So, right. So, meaning now it's clear. We know what it is, and that it's fine. So, actually, if you were to go to a Yemenite shul, they both translate into Targum Unculus and into Targum Yonatan, meaning Targum Unculus for Torah, Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel for when they read the Haftarah. So, happen to be in Israel or in Brooklyn, the only places I know of that still do that. Because I don't think there's any Yemenite shuls anywhere else but those two places, so you will see that. So now Rabbi Yonatan ben Uzziel wanted to reveal a translation of Tuvim, but Bat Kol stopped him, stating that it is enough for you translating the prophets. And the Gemara says, why is that a problem? Because you translated fully that is included in the Tuvim, you would have revealed the end of days, and we can't have that. So, and then Rashi and others say that is referring to Daniel, because there are certain things there that if you explain will reveal the end of days. So, but now the Gemara is a problem that says, wait, how can you say that the translation was written by Onkelos, the convert? Didn't Rav Ika Bar Avin quote Rav Chananel, quoting Rav, stating that they read in the book the Torah of God distinctly, and they gave the sense, and they caused them to understand the reading, right? So this is for, that's a pasuk quoting from Nehemiah when he reads before all of them. In Hebrew is Vayikra'u b'sefer Torah Tehelokim Meforash v'Shom Zechel v'Avinu b'Mikra. It's a question. So that whole pasuk, like, what does that whole pasuk mean? So then they expounded it, saying that they read from the book of the Torah, meaning they read the Torah itself. And then when it said Meforash, this is referring to that they read it with the Targum. So, right. So now, and then they continue on with the rest of the verse. So what does it say that they gave sense? This is saying that they laid it with a tune to distinguish the separate verses, and that caused them to have greater understanding of the reading. Sorry, that is the cantillation notes. The one is the separating the verses. The next is the cantillation notes. And some say the last one is the traditions on how the Masoretic traditions on how each word is to be written. So. And then the question is, so how is this possible? Answer being is that they'd forgotten it, meaning that all these things they'd always known Targum Onkelos. Rather, Onkelos came and reestablished it. So the question is that really necessarily what historically happened or not? So that is up for debate. If there really was an Aramaic translation or not, it's not entirely clear. Okay, so now let's continue. So... here, right, so it seems now we know there's two translations. There's one of Torah by Onkelos, which seemingly has completely replicated that of something of divine nature. And then we have the second set, meaning that of Nevi'im by Yonatan ben Uzziah. The only problem is that I mentioned all the different Targumim, and there are quite a few. And also there also are Targumim that we have found on books that weren't like on Ketuvim, which shouldn't be. So what's going on here? Let's see, look in the order that I put it in the slideshow. So the first question is, who's Onkelos? To confirm who's Onkelos, so there's a couple backstories here. So I'll go through them in brief. So one story about Onkelos. So Onkelos is the son of Clonimus, and he is the nephew of the Roman emperor. Question of which one, whether it's Hadrian or Titus, depending on the Gersa. So we will leave it be that as it may.
I thought he was the son of Uzziah.
This is Onkelos, right? So Onkelos is the first translation. He's older, so generally believed to have lived in the first century, first or second century. Shortly after the destruction, as we'll see by some of the other stories.
Wasn't his name in the last slide, Onkelos ben Uzziah?
Where does it?
The slide before.
No, that was Yonatan ben. That was Yonatan ben Uzziel. He was the second.
Oh, Yonatan ben. My apologies.
Okay, so Yonatan ben Uzziel, he's one of the Tanaim.
Right.
So, but again, a little bit later. The Onkelos is from the first or end of the first towards the second century common era. So one story involving him is the story about how after he converted, so his uncle, the emperor, wanted to, wanted to bring him back to Rome, and he refused. And each time he sent a troop, he would convert them, right? So the first time he, learned Torah with them, they converted. The next group was told to be silent. And then he, of course, then as they're walking back, he started talking with them and, of course, made them all convert by talking about how the fact that normally there's a sequence of who honors whom. High is, only somebody lower will honor somebody above them. Yet God carried a torch for the Jews in the desert for 40 years. So clearly the Jews are of high value, and then they all converted. And then similarly, they tried again. This time they said, you must not say a word. But this time, as he left the room, he decided to reach, he pointed towards the mezuzah. And then they're like, hey, what are you pointing at? And he's like, so then he said, you tell me. And they said, well, you tell us. We don't know what this is. And then he then explained the purpose of mezuzah to protect. Normally, the guards protect the king. Here, the king protects people inside, namely us. So that again convinced them all to convert. And therefore, no more soldiers were sent out because he converted everybody. So that is the one story of, you know, of Uncleus and how he, you know, managed to increase the faith. So, but there's another option. There's another backstory that happened when he was still not yet converted, which is a story about how he, in order to figure out whether he should convert or not, he started doing some necromancy. So this is again, a little fantastical, where he raises from the dead first his uncle Titus, and then he asks him, you know, who is most important in the world, you know, in the afterlife, and then he says the most important one is the Jewish people, and right, and then he says you should definitely fight against them, because if you do so, you'll become important, and that's all that matters. Then Uncles is like, so what are you doing now? And he said, well, currently they every day my ashes are I'm burned alive, then my ashes are scattered away, and then repeated every single day. So it's like, so that's his punishment. So then, and then Uncles did the same thing that somebody raised with the wicked Bilam, and a similar story. And Bilam said, you know, you shouldn't do it because you'll be ruined. You'll be doomed if you do, doomed if you don't, based on Pasuk and Devarim, and asked, what is your punishment? His punishment was being cooked in boiling semen. Quite gross, but yeah, that was Bilam's punishment. Again, for more on that, then he raised Jesus from the dead. So in case you're wondering who was responsible for that whole incident, the answer is the fault is Uncleus. And then said, you know, and he said, you know, then Uncleus asked the same, should I convert? He asked that to Jesus of Nazareth. And he said that, actually, you shouldn't really do that either. Right, quoting from Zechariah, that the welfare you shall not seek. And anyone who touches them is regarded as if you're touching the apple of his eye. So basically, if you were to convert, it would be bad for you too. Of course, Uncleus then asks, what's your punishment? He says, well, currently you're in boiling excrement. As I said, whoever mocks the sages will be punished that way. And so, therefore, anyhow, point being in the end is that these people did not sway Uncleus. Rather, Uncleus still stayed fast. Again, this story being a little more fantastical, and yeah, but is a story about Uncleus. We'll leave it at that. Probably more meant for more agadic purposes than necessarily historicity. But the idea of, you know, him turning down other religions and other ways of life to choose Judaism is the overall point of the story. If we had more time, I'd tell you more. I'd go more into what's going on here, but that's for another time.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why is it that when they translated the Torah into Greek, it was like people were ripping their clothing and fasting? And here, when we did it to Aramaic, there's no mention of it.
Well, one could say it's the first time versus the second time, meaning, as in, once it's been done already, it's no longer as big of a deal. You could also say the difference being is in what's it being translated for. Right, the translation of into Aramaic is designed for the Jews, right? So the Jews can understand it, not so that, you know, some Greek who thinks he's all that wants to, you know, see what the Jews stuff is. It's very different than, you know, trying to make sure that all Jews understand the Torah. It's a very different purpose involved. So that would be a very big difference in terms of the goal. So one of those is a very positive goal. One of those is a goal that's probably frowned upon, and many would say it's biblically prohibited to teach Torah to non-Jews. For how that work plays out nowadays is a good question. For more on that, again, that's more of a local question that I'm not going to touch. But there are opinions that you can't teach any Torah at all to non-Jews. So again, that might be part of the play, the role there as well. So now the question is, just in terms of something that came up last week, that people may remember, is we quoted a Yerushalmi in Megillah, which said that there's some that Rabbi Yirmiya, in the name of Rabbi Chia Barba, said that Achilas the convert translated the Torah into what language? So actually, this is the Gemara talking about Yafet, and notice the conclusion at the end, Yaf Yafis bin Bnei Adam. So this is saying as Uncleus, as Achilas, which sounds a lot like Uncleus, translated it into Aramaic, starting to Greek there. It's post Aramaic is what we have, right? Our Gemara says, look at the same names, Rabbi Yirmia, Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Torah, Unkelos Ager Amaro. There's another difference is that one of them says that he said it with traditions of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. That's the Bavli, whereas Yerushalmi said that simply he presented it before these Tanaim who were very impressed by it. So the question is, so what is going on here? Right? So is Unkelos Akilas? Are they different people? Is there some mistake going on here? So there's different schools of thought for that. So some schools of thought say they're different people and simply people, you know, misattributed the translation. Unkelos and Akilas are different people and it was just a mistake of the Babylonians. So that is one answer. That is the least fun answer. The answer that's here. So here, this is the answer held by majority of academics as well as by the, for a list of a few names. So we have the Pnei Moshe, we have Maram Fulda, an author to come here on the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Korban Eda, we have the Vilna Gaon, we have Shadal, who all say that actually, so what happened here in this story, let's go back, sorry. What happened here is, so there was a person named by the name of Akilas, right? So he had, as is the tradition of the church fathers and of other, Akilas first translated it into Greek. He made a more literal translation of the Torah into Greek. After the original Septuagint, he made that. But then what did he do afterwards? Afterwards, he also made an Aramaic, he made an Aramaic one afterwards, right? After he converted, right? As he was in the process of converting, he decided to translate the Torah into Greek. And then after he converted, he's like, well, this is silly. Like most Jews speak Aramaic, not Greek. So let's do it into Aramaic so that all the Jews can know it. Cause I know that I convinced myself and a lot of my Roman friends to convert, but like we really should let that be something more useful for people. So then they changed it. Right. So that's their opinion is that Unkelos wrote both. And right, just he's so Unkelos and Akilas is the same name, simply he authored the translations at different points in time.
Somebody undertook such a grand enterprise to start translating the whole thing.
If you translate it once, you could translate it twice, and especially if that's the reality is that. There are a lot of commonalities between, let's say, the way that it's described Akilas' translation. Like when they say his Greek translation, the way it was lauded for being more literal and precise. And the fact that, features of Targum Unkelos is that it is more literal and precise with less deviations than the original Septuagint had. The fact that it avoids anthropomorphization of God, which is also a feature listed of both of the translations. And the question of the dialect that's being used also seem to indicate that would be the case. But again, it is debated. So be that as it may, some date the Targum Unkelos to being quite late. So then it does appear to have undergone some degree of editing when it was in Babel. There are certain Babylonian Aramaic things that slipped in, but overall it is written in the Aramaic of the time period where Unkelos would have lived. And therefore, it stands, and the region that he supposedly lives, so therefore it stands for reason that he is who he says he is and did what he said he did. Not that there aren't other academics that say otherwise, but again, that's generally, many academics say that also. As in, it's not just, like rabbis, other people also say it, as did the early church fathers were also in agreement. Epiphanius, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly at all. We got one of the church fathers in the fourth century CE also believed in that theory. So, that was, like within 200 years of having been written. So as in you can take or leave the church fathers when like his, the fact whether he's a valid testimony, because it is 200 years, but it's that does indicate that by the time of the Gemara, nobody was really arguing it. And whether they were Jewish or Christian, everybody was like, yeah, that's kind of how it went. So if that was pretty much the agreement, that's how it went. So even though that different narrative is saying, oh, but I think they're different people. So again, you could argue it's different, but other option is that some of the things that would indicate that the Targum Unkelos might be late is simply because, well, a lot of times that text, particularly ones that are read frequently in synagogue, get changed when they get recopied a million times. That is also an option, but most people are pretty sure that he did both. Like, because Yerushalmi says he did it into Greek with the name Akilas, and then the Bavli says Unkelos, same story, same Tanaim, but into. The question is it simply one of those is correct, one of those is wrong? So most people are pretty sure that, well, we also do have evidence of Akilas being a translation. Like last week I mentioned the Hexapla. So one of the translations listed on the Hexapla is Akilas. So it would stand, and that it's the description of Akilas lined up with Unkelos also. So as in like some of the praises for him. So as in they're pretty sure that Akilas translation also existed. So as in the fact that there's two converts with very similar names. Question is they, was it simply a mistake? They got mixed up? Or are they just simply the same guy and just, you know, slightly different, like, you know, it is like who did both things and just, you know, certain people remember certain parts of it. So again, what's more likely? I don't really know. That's more of like, that's one of those, like, you can't really be Malchariah and decide one way or the other type things. Okay. Right. So again, the things we know for sure is that the Targum that we now call Targum Unkelos was entirely accepted by all of Bavel and all of Jewry worldwide for roughly millennia as being the standard thing to use. So the only problem with this is that, well, we know that there are other Targumim. So what's going on with other Targumim and how do they fit in? So let's take a look at that and some of the other ones. Okay. So one of them is Targum Pseudo Jonathan. Okay. Right, it's often listed as Targum Yonatan in the if you were to be looking in your Mikra Kedolot, but it is most definitely not Targum Yonatan because Targum Yonatan, we know he only translated Yonatan ben Uziel, he only translated the Targum of the Nevi'im. So how did this happen? So the answer is because when you abbreviate Targum Yisrael or Yerushalmi as Taf Yud, then you right. So in reality, there were two traditions as to what at least two. There was that of the Babylonian one, Targum Unkelos, which is they attribute to being from Unkelos by Unkelos. And then we have Targum Yerushalmi, which is the stuff that they were used to be reading in Shul in Israel. So an interesting point about Targum Yonatan is that there are a lot of long Midrashic editions that tend actually to line up roughly with where the 3-year cycle for reading the Torah at the head of Israel. Typically, at the end of those is where you find these nice midrashim added. And also, it's written in Galilean and Aramaic, like that of the Talmud of Yerushalmi. Often, typically, it's dated between the 4th and the 12th century, meaning the 4th is because, well, that's the Aramaic is written in for the most part, and they say, I found all that's in the 12th century because it mentions people like Fatima, namely the wife of Muhammad, which would have to date it much later, especially because a lot of legends about her that are quoted don't even appear till far later, as well as some of the Midrashic editions that are included in Targum Yonatan, meaning Pseudo Jonathan, would indicate that parts of it are really old, parts of it were definitely edited way later, because it's quoting Midrashim that necessarily exists prior. So that's why it generally is, so its dating is a little bit of a mess. As far as one that we know a little bit better, as far as its dating, so that is something called, there's something called fragmentary Targum and the Karganiza. So these were basically fragments of other Targum scattered around that we found in various places, also found in the Karganiza particularly. So those generally, in terms of their type of Hebrew, of Aramaic, it's similar to Galilean Aramaic, similar to that of the Targum Pseudo Jonathan that everybody has. But again, it's distinct. It's different. We'll look for a little bit at some of the differences, and they're not the same. So clearly not the same thing. But as far as the best example, but we know for sure there's something different. This is the most recently discovered one. It's called Targum Neophiti. Called that because it's from the College of the Neophytes. This is the first page of the actual manuscript. Right, it was discovered in the Vatican in the 1950s when a church father was, you know, looking through it, noted who was Hebraist, noticed that it was mislabeled and realized that this is not Targum Unkelos, this is something else, and then started publishing it, and then now we have this. right? As far as it's dating, so based on its style of Aramaic, they're pretty so time period wise, they could date the Aramaic to be between, so it was written sometime between the first and the fourth century CE. Exact dating within there is unclear. Also, the only thing we have is a manuscript from the 1600s, but that's still pretty good as far as you know, that's a full, complete Targum that's distinct from Targum. That's not Targum Yerushalmi. That's not the Targum Pseudo-Donathan. That's not Targum Onkelos. So now you know that there's at least two floating around. And there also have been partial ones also found in Dead Sea, amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls and other places in that Judean desert. So again, so we know that there was at least three going around. But actually, there's actually a fourth one I forgot to mention. The name of that is something called the Pshita. So this one actually is preserved thanks to the Syrian, the Syriac Church, meaning the Syrian Church. So they spoke Aramaic. They didn't adopt, you know, the Greek Septuagint like everybody else did. Rather, they canonized a Syriac Aramaic translation. Syriac is the name of the characters that you see on the right there. Here is a 9th century manuscript of theirs. Right. So, and it is. It most likely was translated in the 2nd century CE. It often has Midrashic interpolations similar to the other one does, but as far as the type of Aramaic, it is a different style of Aramaic from farther north in Israel. And so, and again, so thank you to the Syriac Church for canonizing it and keeping it as part of their Old Testament, which is why we actually still have it. Right, so it's an entire complete translation of all of Tanakh into Aramaic. So again, by whom? Unclear. Definitely not done by anybody who the Babli thought was of importance or cared about. But in all likelihood, was definitely done by somebody who was Jewish. There's actually commentary written on it by Reb Chaim Heller. Link is in the slideshow. And also, people may remember Rabbi Ezer Diena. So he actually himself had written a commentary. He got very into Peshitta at some point and wrote a commentary on Bamidbar. Based on the Pshita. He apparently lost the that when his computer crashed. So for all those who have any good questions about Pshita, feel free to ask Rabbi Diena. He knows far more about it than I do. I asked him to give me a summary and some pointers because honestly, like, I haven't really read it properly so much. So, okay. So now before we get to the future of it in Shul, I'm going to do a new share, namely that of some of the Targum. Okay. So here is, we're going to go through, I guess, I'm looking at the time now. I see that we're approaching 45 minutes. So we're going to just focus on one Pasuk. Okay. So here, so I'd like to thank Rabbi Jeremy Weider, a rabbi of mine from Yeshiva University, who taught me a lot about Targumim. Actually, I had a class with him called Targumim. Right, so all the color coding that you see here is because he does, is his doing. He asked him for his files and he sent them to me, so I use it for the shiur. Right, so where he points out the changes made by the various translations. You see here we have first one A, which is Onkelos / or Achilas. Right, then we have Pseudo-Donathan, Neophyte, Fragmentary, Commentary number one, Fragment number two, as well as then I added in the Pshita, courtesy of Rabbi Diena for asking Jay Karen, if you guys know who he is, to put it into legible Hebrew characters as opposed to Syriac, because, well, yeah, I can read Aramaic, but I cannot read Syriac. So for instance, when we have the question of Vayitrotesim habanim b'kirba v'tomerim kelim azay nogi v'teichu rosh Hashem, right? So this is the pasuk where the children are fighting in Rivka's belly, right? Who will soon be, we know, we're going to be Esav and Yaakov, and she asks, so why am I alive? And then she goes to seek out God, l'drosh Hashem. So what does that mean? So, well, one thing is that we see a translation here amongst all of that, well, all of them besides Pshita of the fighting is called dahakin, like pushing one another. We see that they translate inside her to be non-literal and said, say, in her innards, bime'eha. All another translational difference is that it says, is that whether instead of saying dain, which would be this, it says denan, which is these, referring to both the children inside of her. And also the question is, what does it mean to go seek out God? right? So one option is to go seek, which is that of onkelos, is to go seek out a learning from God, like a teaching, right? Seek, right? So that's one option. Another option is that, which is more than that of a, right? So notice the blue, which is when we get to ones that is less literal, right? So, right. So that's the, notice that they added in the phrase that it's childbirth is the pain that's being referred to here, opposed to these phrases, which just says, Lama Zanoki, why am I? They add in, oh, by the way, it hurts. And also they change it to, and the ones that I mentioned that Pseudo Jonathan Neophiti and the other fragmentary Targumim often add in Midrashim. So the Midrash they add in here is the fact that Rivka went to Shem Be'ever, right? Yeshua Shem Be'ever, the Beit Midrasha of Shem Rabbah, of the great Shem, right? So to go ask, and asked him to not just ask what God had to say, but to ask God to pray for Rachamim, for compassion, because man, it really does hurt having twins who are fighting the whole time in your belly. Right. So again, so there we see an excellent example of all of, again, both of the very different relationships that them had. See, Onkelos is one who tries to be the most literal, as opposed to the rest who have no problem just like saying Midrashim, you know, whenever they think it'll add, or adding in other phrases to explain. Which the question is, what's going on with all those additions? Like, why would you need all those additions? Couldn't you simply just leave it literally and then just stop? Well, the answer is why they need a little bit. Even Onkelos has a little bit of explanation where he says, instead of Lidrosh, instead of Mitba, Ben Gadam Hashem, like to ask from God and leave it there, which makes no sense. He says that she at least asks for teaching from God, right? Which she gets back in the form of a nevuah. So now let's head back to part of the reason why this is important and relevant is that it was actually read as part of liturgy, right? So if you had an incomplete translation that was just, you know, like, you know, Google translated, but illegible, and you read that in shul, you're going to have a lot of people screaming at you saying, what on earth are you saying? Right? So that would not be a good thing to do. So now let's talk about the use of Targum in shuls. Okay, so when did it start? So the Yerushalmi Megillah, note this Gemara, this is the, right, so this is also the same Gemara that we had before. Right, we have this, the parallel one quoted in the beginning of Masechta, the parallel one quoted in the Talmud Bavli, where it says, from where is Targum? Right, so here, this is saying, what is the source of Targum? Whereas before just saying, it, so then here, it's, this is quoting it as, this is the original source of Targum. But here, it doesn't seem to be referring to Targum Onkelos. It's first saying the fact that you even use Targum at all. And here it says that, why would you start using Targum? So this is Rabbi Zera and said the name of Rabbi Hananel. And they read the book of the law of God. This is the Bible. Clearly, this is the Targum. They gave the sense. These are the diacritical marks, meaning, you know, like where you end the verses. And so people do the reading, and this is the Masorah, the tradition, right? So again, we'll not, others say this is referring to the Hechraim, the Halach decisions, or between Kray Octave. Others say this is the Rosh Hepsutim, the where the beginning of the verses are. So, point being of this whole section is that seemingly that the initial usage of Targum was done by Nehemiah. He was the first one to institute, start publicly using a translation, and he instituted it, and that was in order to, because, well, as we noted from a little bit later in that chapter, they just didn't know Hebrew. So they needed to know Aramaic, because they wouldn't have learned anything at all. But as far as it being a formalized official one, seemingly there was not one yet. So this is the earliest dating of when it was formally used in shul by Nehemiah when he first came back and noticed nobody knew Hebrew anymore. He said, yeah, we got to do this, right? And again, that's Nehemiah of, you know, Ezra and Nehemiah fame, author of one of the books of Tanakh. Not a nobody, right? So then the question that comes up is, well, why do we stop? Right? Why don't we go to shul and we still do targum? So here is the tour, right? So writing in that is in the 15th century, you know, explaining why 14th century. Okay. Right. Stating why this is the case. So he says so we'll go with the English, just in interest of time. Original Hebrew is there for you as well. The ellipses are because, well, I left off the explained earlier about how they used to do it in shul. So at the time of the Talmud, they used to translate using Targum, meaning Targum, Targum Onkelos or Targum Yonatan for Nevi'im, in order so that people would understand, because they only spoke Aramaic. Now, fast forwarding several hundred years to the time of the Gaonim. We're now in the 9th century. So here we have Rabbi Netra Nagon, who was, again, the head of the yeshiva in Sura, and who said that those who don't read Targum during the Torah reading and said that we don't need the Targum of our sages, rather we want one in our language that we understand, are not fulfilling their obligation of Targum and are required to use Targum. And if they refuse to use Targum rebelliously, they are sinners. And if they don't know how to Targum, they should learn how. And if they need someone to explain the Targum, they can have another person explain the Targum. So, right? So what was Rabbi Netra's going to say? He says, no, you got to read it in Hebrew, read Onkelos or in Tambin Aziel. And if you guys don't understand that, fine, get a third guy up there to translate it into language you guys understand. But he really said, you should all learn it.
Excuse me.
I don't know what's going on here. You should all learn Aramaic. That. So I will note that, less than 100 years after Infernagon, we have Rav Sajagon translating it into Arabic. So we'll get into that a little more next week. So but then the question
when you say why did we stop, for many people they didn't stop. There's a strong tradition of Shnai Mikra V'Chai Targum to this day that people do it on a weekly basis.
Right. So that's a separate thing. And the question is, why do we have that as a requirement? So many say that was in order to be prepared to be able to read it either read the Torah or read the Targum on Shabbos. Is why that was instituted. So what you needed to do. But most people don't, who do Shnai Mikra V'Chai Targum nowadays, use Rashi, not Onkelos, because most people don't understand Onkelos, which is a shame. For if you want to do it with Targum, Onkelos, I recommend you get the new Art Scroll translation of Onkelos. It is excellent, and it lines up the words nice and easy. It points out all the differences. And it's got an excellent commentary on the bottom where it points out why they're different and what the reasons various commentators have said over the generations. But back to the question of why we stopped. So by the time of the Tosfot, the 12th century, right? So they wrote on the Gemara that was discussing in Brachot, that was discussing how Targum is read, and said that it appears that even the time of the sages, so the Talmud replaces with the word Targum, right? Because it says that B'makom, because Targum places that have Targum on, those that don't. So therefore, that supports our custom to not read Targum. And the Yerushalmi, we see that they, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, they talk about fast days, and there's no mention of using Targum. They go through all the details of a fast day. There's no mention of using Targum. So clearly, you could or you could not. It was an option. And we just chose the don't use Targum option because none of us speak Aramaic. Not the Tosfot didn't speak Aramaic. They probably did. But the fact that the average person did not speak Aramaic, therefore, it was just, an extra half an hour in shul, and everybody's just like, I don't get it. So they got rid of it. Right, so it appears, and then it continues that the Torah continues explaining the situation, right? And it appears that they used to explain to the masses who spoke Aramaic, but for us, what is the point of Targum? We don't understand it, and we shouldn't explain it to the people in a language that they understand, because one can say that Targum is different as it was written with Ruach HaKodesh. So that the conclusion at the end of the Torah is. Should we instead, do Hebrew, then, lingua franca? The answer is, well, probably, but because everybody knows the translations are lacking and there's something special about Targum Onkelos, so we don't. So, but again, would it be possible, let's say, to, want to do it in shul, read it in Hebrew than in English? Maybe, but you're not going to be able to get it off the ground either, because either A, nobody has time for that. Or because people will scream at you and say, you can't do that because, well, who says that translation is right? So once they're screaming at you anyways, shuls will take even longer. So just, the compromise that I've seen in some shuls is that they give a brief introduction to the Aliyah before, right? So they say, we're about to read the Aliyah about, and say, give like a, like a 30-second summary. And then, people can choose to follow it in English or in Hebrew and read ahead at their own pace. What? Right, so that is, I've seen that in some shuls. For instituting that practice in your shul, please talk to your local Orthodox rabbi. I am not suggesting you do that at the Bayit. But if somebody would like that to happen, please ask. Okay, but I didn't say that. So now just to sum up what we covered and go back to the beginning, and that's the summary of the guy that we had. So we'll see how much everybody remembers, okay? So, we discussed. What is Targum? meaning a translation of the Torah into Aramaic. We discussed why we have them, due to the either because of God thought it worthy to give us on our Sinai, or because we forgot Hebrew, and therefore we had to have it taught to us in Aramaic. As far as the type of Targumim, so there is Targum Onkelos and Targum Yonatan, which are the ones that the Talmud Bavli approves of. There also are many others, such as the Pshita, which is the Syriac translation. There is Targum Neufiti and Targum Yerushalmi, and as well as other fragments of other Targum that existed at the time of the following the destruction of the Korban and around the time of the Korban. Of the first several centuries in Eretz Yisrael, seemingly there was a set text for Targum in Bavel, but there was not a set one in Eretz Yisrael. And as far as someone was used in Shul, so if you were in Bavel, they were all using Targum Yonatan and Targum Onkelos. But if you happen to have been in Eretz Yisrael, well, you might have gotten, you know, the person who translated the Pshita, you might have gotten the Targum Yerushalmi, Targum Neufiti. You could have gotten anything, depends on what your Shul decided was the what was the local opinion on what the best translation was. If anybody has any questions about anything that I've spoken about, feel free to chime in now. I see that we went a little over time. So again, if anybody has any questions about Targumim in general or translations, feel free to ask.
Yeah, I have a problem with that. Like, we heard that generally with the called the Trump card when they say Ruach HaKodesh, instead of Shulchan Aruch, it's Ruach HaKodesh, and so on, where I just feel like it's thrown in there.
So what is Ruach HaKodesh, right? So how can that be a thing? Like, how can you say that a book was written with Ruach HaKodesh, right? So what does that mean? Generally, that's reserved for canonical books, right? We say that the Torah is the word of God. The Nevi'im is the word of God through prophets that are lesser than Moshe Rabbeinu. And what is Ketuvim? They were written with Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. So the question is, so then how could you say that other things that aren't part of Ketuvim are written with divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh? So one is that it might not necessarily be a literal divine spirit as let's say something that's in Ketuvim. It means that it was, that God must have been instrumental and inspired the person who wrote it, because there's no other way that you could conceive of a translation gaining the acceptance or a work getting that acceptance that it did. For instance, the degree of acceptance that was received by Targum Onkelos is immense, right? So we, you could, I mean, the level, the answer is that Shulchan Aruch elevated the, in terms of replacing a din of Shai Mekmecha Targum, used to be only do with Onkelos, said you can be Yotze with Rashi. So we elevated it to roughly the same level. Okay, what, would you say that it's divine? No. Would you say that there's something unique about it, and that maybe God had a hand in making sure that was one that was chosen over all the other ones? Perhaps. So then to say that, you know, to say that though there is a phrase that you may see quoted, that Targum Nitan V'Sinai, that the Targum, like, Onkelos was given on her Sinai, but again, whether that means it's literal or just that certain traditions that later came out in it were given is also part of the question. So that I don't have an answer for, because it's debated. Does that answer the question? I mean, the answer is that if something became accepted, that in and of itself is some degree. If there is a general belief in Hashgacha Pratit of divine providence, then the fact that something becomes the accepted thing without pretty much any debate amongst all of Jews, and we know two Jews, three opinions, so, you know, millions of Jews, one opinion is very rare. So there must be something special if that becomes the case for some particular text or work, such as, let's say, the fact that the Talmud Bavli was so accepted. At one point, there was a fight, is Talmud Bavli or Yerushalmi, but Bavli won out. So then, presumably, God wanted that to happen, because if not, well, we might be doing a lot of things very wrong in Judaism. For following the wrong tradition.
You could argue that it became part of our tefillot, like in Valitzio and Goel.
Right.
Because people didn't understand it. Not because it became holy because everybody agreed it was holy, but because people couldn't understand it, so therefore they needed the translation.
Correct. Right. So that's also a possibility.
Do we still keep it in?
Why do we still keep it in?
Yeah.
Changing davening is a very hard thing to do. And also, particularly in the case of the Targum Yonatan of the verses quoted in in Kedusha. So then those are also verses that are typically mistranslated to refer to, Yeshu Yimach Shmo and, you know, other things. So it's important to have them properly translated so that people know, again, if you look at it, you see that when it says, you know, again, Christians would say Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh refers to, you know, to JC,
the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit,
right? So then, like, that's where there's three. And it's like, no, it's not the case. And if you look at the translation there, it gives different reason why each of the Kadoshas represent. And it's nothing to do with Christianity, obviously. For instance, so since that's the reason why, you know, we say it is for that reason. The fact that nowadays when people don't understand the Aramaic, well, we say a lot of things that we, you know, that made more sense they're instituted, but we kept them around because people found them to be meaningful anyways. A good example for that would be, let's say, the fact that when we say the first Birkot HaShachar, Shalos Ani Goy, Shalos Ani Avot, Shalos Ani Isha. So again, so that was instituted as a response to the Greeks saying that you have not made me a barbarian, you have not made me, again, a slave, and that you have, it is our response to their three not so positive ones. So we came up with our own ones to say why we're proud to be Jews. Then is it nowadays like, but it's, you know, anti-feminist? It's like, that wasn't the point. The point was to keep us all Jewish, not so we don't, you know, get Hellenized. And it's like, not defensive. It's like, I guess. But like, that wasn't the intent. And it's like, yeah, if you didn't update it, that's what happens. And then the added flow site shows like your son and separate women. And it's like, see, now it's fair. So.
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions related or unrelated that are coming into people's heads at the moment? Okay, so if that's all we have for questions, then I would wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody. Hopefully next week when we discuss Rav Sadegon and his translation, as well as the community that he lived in, namely that of, well, Tzura and Bumbadita, as well as the general Arab lands and the Jewry there in the Goanic times.
Thank you.
Thank you.